In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen playground blessed by an unusual variety of natural attractions.
Friday morning, and here he is, Felix Bunnell, with another edition of All Over the Map. A quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. And this week, we travel to a community.
This week, we travel to a community near Stevens Pass.
Where is Tunnel City?
Well, first of all, Stevens Pass is not named for Territorial Governor Isaac Stevens, one of the few places not named for our former Territorial Governor. Named for John F. Stevens, a surveyor who mapped out that route for the Great Northern Railway back around 1890. Yeah, poor guy gets no credit. And that route had a lot of switchbacks, so they decided to build a tunnel. And this tunnel was almost 3 miles long. And before construction began back in 1897, a little community sprung up east of Stevens Pass called Tunnel City. The kids today might call it a pop-up, right? Mm-hmm. There were merchants there. Many had relocated from nearby Leavenworth. There were at least 4 saloons. They were selling all kinds of products and, you know, services to the rough-and-tumble tunnel workers. And so the town of Tunnel City developed a reputation as a temple of sin. And so much was Tunnel City considered a one-stop shopping center for vice that a writer for the New York World wrote a scathing profile of Tunnel City, calling it the wickedest place on earth. And it's this went viral. It was reprinted in newspapers as far
this
away
was
as London.
In Eastern Washington?
Yeah, exactly.
Makes no sense.
Exactly. So there was a guy named Frank Reeves, a local politician and real estate mining broker up there. And in June of 1900, he refuted what the World had said. And he said, quote, Cascade Tunnel is indeed a wicked place. That's what they called the city as well. Because conditions are favorable to the exposure of the rough side of life. And men and women are the same the world over. Some are good, some are bad, others indifferent. None is absolutely spotless, and no one is entirely devoid of good. So he kind of was working both sides of the aisle there. But of course, to put it in perspective, Frank Reeves cast aspersions on our own fair city. He said, the toughest of the Cascade toughs are but mere infants when they get down on a tough street in Seattle, a city of churches, refinement, and education, full of blue-coated policemen and guardians of public morals. So as the wickedest place on earth was nothing compared to Seattle, right? Typical Eastern Washington approach, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, really nothing's changed. Either Tunnel City is wicked or Seattle is dying, right? But a few months after Frank Reeves published his rejoinder, the city was leveled by a fire. So Tunnel City was wiped off the map in June of 1900.
Nothing left?
Pretty much nothing left. I couldn't find any reference
to it.
Did
you still hike up there?
It's right off of Lichtenberg Place, off of Highway 2, just east of the Stevens Pass ski area. There's supposedly nothing there. There's no interpretation. There's nothing of the town site. But it's
I drove through there over the weekend.
Oh, you did?
And I didn't see anything there.
Yeah,
but you have the Nordic Center for East Stevens Pass, and that's about it.
I think it's kind of midway between those two places, actually. Yeah, and it's again, there's no interpretation there. I don't know if there's been any archaeology done there.
Is there still a tunnel there?
The old tunnel is still there, and until 2006, it was accessible on the Iron Goat Trail, but part of the ceiling collapsed back in the winter of 06-07, and it's closed off. It's blocked off. But no, Stevens Pass has this crazy multiple layers of history with the different railroad routes, the Wellington mine disaster, or the big avalanche in 1910, and then the highway that came through. So it's again, these multiple layers plus all the native history.
I've been through the Snoqualmie Tunnel. You've been through that?
I've ridden my bike through that. Yeah, that's awesome. That's very cool. Yeah, yeah.
Crazy. A little point of light at the end.
It's bizarre. Yeah, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and pretty soon you're in the daylight. It's worth it. So lots of cool stuff in the old railroad history around the Cascades.
Felix Bunnell joins us Wednesdays and Fridays. His features are at MyNorthWest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
It was all about your commute in the state Senate last night. KyRadio's Hannah Scott is here. What did they talk about, Hannah?
So this has to do with 405, 167, and what's known as the Gateway Project. Sully, I'll let you tell everyone about that.
Yeah, Gateway Project, something we've been talking about for 2 or 3 years now. This would extend 167, finally complete the highway where it ends now in Puyallup. It would take it all the way over to I-5 just at the Port of Tacoma. 509 then would be extended out of the Port of Tacoma to join 167. There are whole new bunches of interchange. It was and has always been planned to be a tolled road, so it would give us an express toll lane basically from Linwood all the way to the Port of Tacoma once it's all said and done by 2031.
So that was going to be 12 years out. But now what they did last night is the Senate voted to approve a plan that would allow for bonding on future tolls to pay for this project. That's a big concern for Republican Senator Phil Fortunato. He says if they bond against the toll revenue, those roads will have to stay the same for 25 years because any changes would affect the revenue stream of the tolls. On top of that,
in effect, we are financing transportation with bonding toll revenue. So we are financing transportation with congestion. This will simply be a reason to not relieve congestion, but to actually cause congestion to drive up the cost of those tolls.
Now, is the whole road being tolled or just the express toll lanes?
Well, The express toll lanes go down through 16, but then the extension right now from Puyallup to Tacoma and then north from the port of Tacoma would be entirely tolled.
Entirely tolled.
To toll
well, then
facilities.
That argument's wrong then. Because he's saying that they would cause congestion to force people into the toll lanes, but everybody's going to be tolled.
Stretch. Except for 167, all the way from Renton to Puyallup would be exactly like 405 is right now with the express toll system. It's only those corners of the Gateway project itself which would be entirely tolled, as I've been told.
Yeah, and Representative Hans Zeiger, who represents Puyallup, where the Gateway Project would be, said this is why this makes financial sense.
When you combine the additional toll revenue that is to be gained by accelerating the project, you combine that with the $43 million in inflation cost savings that we gain by accelerating the project, and you still account for the debt service on the bonds that are issued. The net financial benefit is $147 million, according to the Department of Transportation.
So fiscally responsible, according to him.
Okay, so the whole purpose is to get this done faster.
Is all to move to accelerate these projects.
So how
That's
long would
idea.
It be done if you go with the tolls?
It goes. It would be done in just about 4 years, I believe.
So for
4 years?
Well, no. The overall. What we would say is instead of 2031, this could be done by 2028. So about 3 years faster.
Well, that's
but you would the tolling would be starting though before the construction.
Right.
Well, as always,
yeah.
We've gotten used to that.
And that was the problem for Representative Peter King.
30% to collect these tolls. 30%. Then you throw in the cost of the bonding, and again. We're lucky to get 50 cents on the dollar, but we're willing to do that because we think these projects are so important they have to be done immediately. Well, what about the rest of the state?
So he's saying we're going to lose more of our toll revenue because we're doing the bonding. There's other stuff in this bill, though, that passed out of the Senate, too. One of the most important ones is that it does away with those performance metrics that were the requirement in the toll lanes in the 2 year pilot.
Now we're talking about the 405 toll lane.
Yeah, the 405, because this bill also makes the 405 167 toll lanes permanent.
Mm-hmm.
405 was a 2 year pilot program, and they had to get it where it was 40. They had to maintain 45 miles per hour 90% of the time standard in order to continue that.
Mm-hmm.
This strips out that language and makes that a goal, not a requirement.
Which is funny because that's the one benchmark that they set that they had to have that was not met. So they've just changed the benchmark.
This presumes, though, that there was some chance they would eliminate the toll lanes and make them general purpose, which was never going to happen because I don't think anybody believes, regardless of whether they meet the benchmark or not, that that would improve traffic, unless you disagree with that.
Right. Well, the benchmark itself is a federal benchmark.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons they said they were going to change is because the feds might be getting rid of this benchmark because toll lanes and HOV lanes around the country are failing miserably right now in terms of their performance.
Uh-huh. Well, are they failing in terms of carrying more people than if you just made them general purpose lanes?
Well, that's the question and that's the argument right now. Yeah. But they're failing because there are just so many people using them and we're not building capacity.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's the problem. At any rate, this passed the Senate last night. It still needs to go through the House. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, it's, at one point, this concerns me. I mean, the goal here is to transport the most number of people in the most efficient way. Are the toll lanes doing that or not?
Well, they're certainly not between Bothell and Bellevue. Excuse me, not between Linwood and Bothell, yeah. Where we have one less lane.
All right.
If they want to accelerate that project, I'm all for it because we need that lane up there.
They've got the money for it, right? I mean, one of the things the tolls do is create a new source of money, which is supposed to be spent on improving the corridor, correct?
Right, but right now the legislature has not approved funding for the expansion from Bothell to Linwood.
Ah, well, that's something to bring
under
up
a transportation plan because they have not passed a transportation.
They haven't passed the transportation budget yet, so yeah. That could be coming to light.
You bring
it
up at your next town hall meeting. You know, when you see that notice in the mail show up and say, "Hey, you got toll revenue. Here's where we need it. How about it?"
Yeah, they're making money hand over fist. Mm. They're on 405 right now.
Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
It took 21 other movies before this day could arrive. But it's finally here. Avengers Endgame. And so is critic Tom Tangney. Now, Tom is not going to be revealing any spoilers for this movie, but there will be spoilers for the previous movie, Infinity War. So if you haven't seen that, then listen and just forget.
Yeah, that's right, which you could easily do if you want. But yeah, this is the movie all the world's been waiting for over a decade. You're right, Dave. So getting back to Avengers Infinity War, the closing scenes, I think, of that movie were so powerful, so poignant, so philosophical that I feared its sequel, Avengers Endgame, would inevitably suffer by comparison. How do you follow up a superhero movie in which not only do the heroes lose the war, but half the population of the universe is wiped out as well, including half of the superheroes? Watching superheroes grapple with failure and death on such a personal level is not something we've come to expect in a Marvel Cinematic Universe. An isolated death here or there, sure, but not literally half of our heroes dissolving before our eyes. Poof, there goes Spider-Man. Poof, so too Black Panther. And on and on and on. So how does Endgame follow up on quite possibly the most profound finale of any superhero movie? By replacing the philosophical with the emotional. Endgame doesn't grapple with ideas the way Infinity War does. It's far less contemplative or reflective and much more emotionally reactive. Rather than provoking thoughts, Endgame elicits claps and tears. And that works just fine for a movie tasked with wrapping up a 22-film cycle with at least that many heroes. It's a finale worthy of the series. Endgame lets the tragedies of Infinity War breathe for a good half hour or so before the remaining Avengers talk themselves into going after the supreme villain Thanos and his six Infinity Stones one more time, even if their forces are severely depleted.
He used the stones again.
Hey, we'd be going in short-handed, you know.
Look, he's still got the stones, so...
So let's get up. Use them to bring everyone back.
Just like that.
Yeah. Just like that.
Even if there's a small chance that we can undo this, I mean, we owe it to everyone who's not in this room to try.
Let's go get this son of a bitch.
And the movie is off and running, Dave. Now, I'm very cognizant of the need to keep spoilers to a minimum. So let me just say that the narrative device the screenwriters use to incorporate the entire roster of superheroes, both living and dead, is a time-honored comic book tradition. It may be hoary, but it cleverly sets up at least six new adventure story timelines. All those storylines and all the unexpected setbacks our heroes face while carrying out their missions take more than 3 hours to resolve, but the pace rarely wanes. It's a masterful balancing act. High-energy action set pieces punctuated by large doses of self-reflexive humor and occasional dollops of pathos. The quibbles I have are mostly minor. The Avengers' various super strengths seem to come and go arbitrarily, especially in battle. The jokes are sometimes belabored, and certain emotional scenes are milked shamelessly. But these deficiencies are more than made up by the film's steady stream of happy surprises, satisfying complications, and enlightening revelations. Avengers Endgame may very well set the record for the highest-grossing opening weekend in American history. If so, it will have earned every dollar.
So, judging by the title, this means the Earth is finally saved for good and there's no more saving that is necessary?
Well, there are always complications, but in terms of the 22 films we've seen before, this kind of wraps up one big... They call it the third phase, Dave. Now, there is a fourth phase in the offing that'll deal with others, but this is the thing that all the movies since the first Iron Man 11 years ago said, they've all been, they're resolved in some way.
And in terms of Thanos offing all these people, wasn't he doing it for a good reason to save the Earth because there was so much overpopulation?
It's not necessarily a good reason, but at least it's a thought-out reason that the world is getting clotted. And we're talking about the entire universe. So he was
trying to get to carbon zero.
Yes, exactly right. In fact, there is a great crack in this. And again, this is just a crack, so I don't think I'm giving anything away. There's a crack when Captain America shows up and is talking to, I think, Black Widow. And she says, wow, you got here fast. And he says, well, with half the ships clogging the harbor and the pollution non-existent, I got here pretty quick. And she looked at him like, oh, I'm going to smack you one. Because it is true. When the world, if there are half of us here, the world would work better. And that is the Malthusian life principle that Thanos is actually, you know, arguing for. But most of us don't think it's worth sacrificing half of the people on the planet just to get a better life for the other half.
Okay, Tom, talk to the Neanderthals in the group.
Yes.
Or maybe I'm the only one who doesn't give a rip, hasn't seen any of these superhero movies, but this is such a big deal. who might want to go. Why should I go? Would I be lost? Do I need to watch? What do you need to do?
Here's the one thing I would say, because it's so crucial to know what happened in Infinity War. Because basically, although there are 22 films, that's like part one and this is like part two. What I would do is, if you don't have time to watch another 2 hour and 40 minute movie, I would read the plot summary of Infinity War to set you up for this. So take 5 minutes out of your time to, you know, to set up who Thanos is and what happens at the end of that.
Like you do before you go to the opera, Chris.
Well, I research extensively.
Yeah.
But this, no.
But that would be all you need to know. You need to know about the six Infinity Stones and Thanos and what happens at the end of that. And then the rest of this makes sense because, you know, superheroes, even if you don't know who's that. In fact, there's this one great line when Thanos is fighting all these superheroes. Another one of the 22 or 23 superheroes shows up and he goes, "I don't even know who you are." Everybody laughs because it's true. It's hard to keep track.
So out of four Tangs, how many Tangs for
Avengers Endgame?
Yeah.
Easily four Tangs out of four.
Wow.
And by the way, the other controversy is it is over 3 hours long?
It's 3 hours and I think 2 minutes.
Three hours and 2 minutes long. Well, that's not too bad. Did you have a lot of people getting up to use the restroom in the middle of the movie?
This is hilarious. I hope he doesn't get mad for me saying this, but I saw it with Jason Rance. Mm-hmm. Jason Rance has, I think he has a small bladder because he always gets up and goes to the bathroom, and he sat through the entire 3 hours.
He did.
And I asked him about that. He says, "How'd you survive?" And he says, "First off, I'm absolutely dehydrated. I haven't had anything to drink since 6 in the morning." We saw it. It was about a 10:30 screening that we saw. So, and the problem is there a good time to take a bathroom break? No. You're going to miss everything. The pacing is unbelievable.
So you've got to prepare that.
Yeah, I would be well prepared.
I mean, the people who are complaining are the ones who they buy the rain barrel-sized Coke, and then they wonder, why do I have to...
That rain barrel-sized Coke can also be used to expel.
Oh, my God.
Just Jeez, FYI.
Come on.
Who invited
That's why
Chris?
I don't go to the movie.
Thank you, Tom.
Sure, anytime.
Your daily dose of kindness now. The Seahawks picked up defensive end L.J. Collier in the draft last night. They've got two picks today. But what's special about today's selection is who will be calling out the names. 13-year-old Owen Church will be on stage to call out the name of whoever the Seahawk picks in the third round. He is a cancer survivor. At age 4, he began the fight of his life against acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Owen endured years of intensive life-saving therapy. And he says he used the 2012 Hawks team as inspiration to finally beat cancer in that year. So the NFL, St. Jude's, and the Hawks came together to show their support for Owen now. And he told us how he learned about the opportunity.
Well, I was actually at school, and my mom called me, and I was super excited because this is a big deal, one-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It was just awesome for me. And I'm very grateful for St. Jude that they gave me the chance to do this.
The Seahawks reaching out once again in a big way. Always a reason to be proud of our team. Owen is going to make the announcement with Sean Alexander, too, the NFL MVP, when the Hawks made their first Super Bowl appearance.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Now here he is, the man who can write a 40-inch sports column in 6.5 seconds, Danny O'Neill.
Please beatbox again.
No. Never mind. Hi.
Hi. What's going on?
LJ Collier. I was looking at his highlight reel, and it was pretty impressive.
And second down and long. Collier, the pressure and the sack. Boy, number 91. He got through in a hurry. That's his fourth sack of the season.
Well, look at those highlight reels. A sack after sack after sack.
Yeah. Generally, you can make a guy, if you use a first round pick on a guy that you can't put together an impressive highlight reel on, you're in trouble. Like, if you've got 5 years of history to be able to put together his five best plays, doesn't mean he's going to be a great player. This is the typical Seahawks pick in that no one forecast it. Mm-hmm. And he was drafted and everybody goes, who?
Did that coordinate with Pete Carroll had released that video on social media of him playing the piano?
They give draft hints every year. I've stopped trying to read into any of it. Okay. I think it's all nonsense. Okay. I hope it's all nonsense.
I didn't know he could play the piano, so
I know.
That was impressive.
What'd you think? It was the tune that he played, Yeah. It was pretty good, but I didn't know how complicated it was.
I can't remember now the song. Let me look it up.
I've heard him play chopsticks before. He could. He's got some skills on the black and white ivories.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Stand by me.
Oh, yeah.
No, Lean on Me.
Yeah. Lean on Me.
Yeah. Mm. So he's there playing the piano. What does that have to do with Collier?
I hope it doesn't have anything to do with Collier. Because if the coach is giving out hints on who they're going to pick on social media, that would probably be a major faux pas. I think it's just a fun little thing he has, kind of cheeky thing to do with the fans who follow it. But nobody predicted LJ Collier. In fact, we talked to a teammate of his in trying to narrow in on who the Seahawks would draft. There was a different defensive end from TCU that we talked to, Ben Banigou. So they didn't even pick the most athletic defensive lineman on that team. But their track record is so good with the guys. When John Schneider stands up there and says, look, this is our type of guy, you sit there and go, okay, they do have a fair degree. There was early in John's tenure as a GM, I would take it personally that I would spend, as a Seattle Times journalist, 2 weeks writing about the draft and who they might pick, and then never mention the guy they ended up choosing. Never mentioning him. Never once. I used to take it personally, and now I just realize that's just part of the approach that the Seahawks have. They're very, very tight-lipped. Mm-hmm. They're not going to tell you that the guy that they're going to pick is even a first-round draft candidate. Hmm. They would absolutely not comment on him at all to give you any indication that they even thought he was a good player, let alone a guy they were targeting.
Here's how the call went when John Schneider delivered the news.
Hello?
LJ.
Who am I talking to?
This is John Schneider. I'm general manager of the Seattle Seahawks.
What's up?
How you doing, man?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. We're getting ready to select you here, okay, partner?
What's up? One more time?
Come on in. We want you to come in and get after that quarterback, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
All right. Congratulations, man. Here's Coach Carroll, okay?
Let's go.
All right, bro.
Let's get it.
Hey, LJ.
Let's go!
Hey, LJ,
oh, that gave me chills. Oh, okay. How special.
It's pretty awesome.
That's a big deal.
It is a big deal. Ugh. And that's the best part about the draft. Yeah. It's not the lead up in the grades that people are going to give him. That guy has worked for 5 years at TCU to get to a point, and he went into last night. He's from Monday, Texas. There were 25 people in his graduating class. He was one of 25 graduating seniors. And for 5 years, he's worked to get to this point. And last night, he went in having no idea that he was going to be picked in the first round. Didn't know. He was someone that was, most people had him projected toward the end of the second round. He was at a motel in Monday, and he had 20 people that he named that were there with him. And they're watching it and kind of waiting, but thinking in the back of their mind, he's probably not getting picked today. And there they are at 30, the third to last pick of the round. And he finds out that he just became the first round selection of the Seattle Seahawks. Let's go!
Love it.
But then they have to come to an agreement. But that's
a done deal. Those things, it's slotted. He's going to be here. He'll be ready for training camp. I think they have a rookie mini camp next year. Yes, I would imagine that if he's not starting, he's going to be a very, very integral part of the rotation. And then the Seahawks, which is they traded back their other pick. They had a pick at 21. They traded back to 30. And then they traded back from there, and they'll have a second-round pick today. They picked up 4 draft choices yesterday. They picked up 3 fourth-round picks and a fifth-round pick. So they went from starting this draft at the beginning of this week, they had 4 draft choices, and now they're going to end up with at least 9.
It makes my head spin. It's like filing taxes. I don't.
Snyder's like a commodities trader. The way they got the 3, then they took 1 and parlayed it into 3 more.
He is like a commodities trader. Yeah. Do you think it's like frozen orange juice concentrate?
I don't know.
Do you think it's pork belly futures?
I just like to find out how he does it, but of course he's not going to share his secrets, so I even bother. By the way, the Mariners won last night.
Yeah, they took the Rangers out to the woodshed, man, and wailed on them for in excess of 3 hours.
Yikes.
You know the turning point?
You know what?
National anthem. Once that was done, it was all downhill for the Rangers. Mariners brought out the whooping sticks.
No, they built up a margin so that they could have withstood 2 grand slams again and still won.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah they just shrugged it off.
That's the way to do it. Just get the 16 runs and
That was 14-0 heading into the 8th inning.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Marco Gonzalez with his 5th win. Let's go!
The ball was dancing.
Yeah, it was.
Have a good weekend.
You do the same, Dave.
Okay, I'll try. Insider brought to you by your Western Washington. Your Western Washington Toyota dealer.
It sounds like a child's ray gun.
I know it does. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. I know that it sometimes leaves parents, shall I say, uneasy to see their college-level kids up till 2 a.m. playing Fortnite. But there are some real skills involved in this, and the University of Washington is, can I say you're on the cutting edge of esports?
Absolutely.
Dr. Camputaro? Dr. Justin Camputaro is with the UW Esports, and you've set up a new gaming center at the Hub. And we're going to talk with one of the people who plays there first, but I want you to give us an image of what this looks like.
So it is a 1,000-square-foot facility that has 40 of the highest-end custom-designed PCs. We designed these machines all around what our students were seeking to be able to play at the highest competitive levels, but also from a casual perspective. We also have virtual reality in the space. We'll have two machines that are running virtual reality, and we have several digital monitors, and as well as later this summer, we'll be building out a full-scale broadcast booth to be able to help.
A broadcast booth?
Absolutely.
So you can stream play-by-play of these competitive tournaments?
Absolutely.
Now, why? are there not enough distractions already at the UW?
It's a great question, and I think one that we probably get asked the most. There is certainly the need for the relaxation and the stress levels to be able to help our students be successful, but this space is so much more than that, and I think that's the piece that I've come to learn over the past few years. The skills that are learned in here from teamwork, from strategy, critical thinking skills, even socialization skills. A lot of the times gaming is one of those things that has had a stigma that you're playing by yourself in your room. And we're building a space where these students get to come together and play together. We're actually going to be, as you mentioned, the broadcast booth, going to be having skill set development if we're going to teach them how to be able to be broadcasters. We'll partner with journalism and broadcast majors. Uh-huh. We're working with several academic units to be able to do research and game design around serious games. Serious games are educational games. We're helping the students develop tournaments, so they're event planners. It's so much more than gaming.
So, Wendy Kang, you've used this new center, and so tell me how important this is to you.
So we opened last week, and having experienced it myself, I can say that it was really fun. The computers are really high-tech, like Justin's mentioned. The space is really comfortable, a lot of ventilation. And it's so inspiring to see a bunch of people around you, some people you know, some people you don't, just having fun playing all these types of games. I mean, knowing that we're going to get more expansion soon and that this space will only continue to grow and thrive.
And what is your major? What are you studying?
I am majoring in human-centered design and engineering, otherwise known as HCDE.
So does this help you?
Yeah, it actually does. So my major focuses on UX and user experience, usability, and games are all about that. They're about understanding, as a consumer, as a gamer, what makes games fun, right? So if you play something and you say, hey, this isn't for me, well, then maybe that's not bad usability, but you certainly didn't have the best user experience.
Dr. Camputaro. Is this moving towards some sort of esports scholarship similar to what you'd see in other sports?
Absolutely. And a lot of other institutions across the country started with that. At the University of Washington, we've kind of flipped the script. For us, the first and foremost piece is building a space about community development. A lot of what Wendy's just been describing of space where friends can come together, where friends are made, and where they're supporting each other. Sense of belonging, sense of community, it is one of the top factors of student success on any college campus and one of the top graduation rate factors. When we do offer scholarships, that's going to go to a much more limited number of students. There might be anywhere from 2, 3, 4, 5 students, something like that, that will end up with scholarships. So that is probably a year or two away for us. We've chosen to invest into a space that affects hundreds, if not thousands, of students in a much more global and positive way.
Well, that's the other thing. Is this a career path in itself? Can you make a living playing video games?
Yes and no. So is it a career path for the pro players? Not as much. It is one of those pieces that are there pro paths? Absolutely. But much like you will see again with basketball, football, all those other sports, it's a micro fraction of those that are going to make pro teams. But the career paths, there are over 425 interactive media companies here in Seattle alone that represent over 23,000 jobs. So there are career paths in game developers, in broadcasters, artists, those that are doing voiceovers, writing, entrepreneurs, an amazing expanse of career paths. So that's part of our program as a career pipeline to this industry, with many of our partners right now helping to be able to offer internships and eventual jobs.
So, Wendy, are you looking at something like that for a career?
Yeah, certainly. I want to be a UX designer coming out of college. I'll be graduating this June. So a UX designer is someone who looks at the user experience of any product they're looking at. If you are frustrated, then you know that's bad UX. It's bad user experience. And it's the same thing with games, because obviously you want something that's efficient. You want something that's convenient and quick and fun. And if you're not getting that experience out of games, then obviously you have to take a look at how they've set that up. What buttons are you having to click to get to a certain thing? Game UX designers would focus on whether those things are easy, convenient, and just make for an overall great experience.
So growing up, how much time did you spend playing video games, and what did your parents think about it?
It's real funny that you asked that, because my parents were the type that definitely disliked video games so much. They told me all the time when I was younger that it's going to rot my brain, and I remember I was told that if I taught my brother, he was in kindergarten at the time, how to read in a year, then I could get a Game Boy Advance. And I did manage to do it, and they lied, and they did not give me one.
So bad when parents do that.
But somehow I still ended up playing games anyway. There are things called emulators that you can download onto your computer, and that's how I grew up. It's a fun hobby for a lot of people, and it's something that can definitely be turned into a career if you enjoy it enough and want to pursue that path.
You must have big dreams for this, because, I mean, the Puget Sound area is a hotbed for computer programming and gaming talent. You've got your eSports center, but you know there's that big old Husky Stadium down the street. I mean, can you envision a day where there's just banks and banks of computer screens set up on the field and a stadium full of fans cheering on Fortnite champions or something like that?
Those already happen across the country. In fact, we have two players right now. They're headed this weekend out to New Jersey, Atlantic City, and they are going to compete in the Star League Fortnite championships, and they're going to compete in something that's not that far off of how you've just described. We had another team that back in the fall were in Atlanta at a hackathon, and they took first place in the Paladins championships, and same thing, and it was an arena sized example like that. So do I think that those types of spaces are going to happen on a daily basis? No, but those types of tournaments, they're already happening, and they're going to continue to grow. Gaming is going nowhere, and so it's right for all of us to be a part of that and to be able to help our students to grow as part of it as well.
Dr. Justin Caputaro is the director of the Husky Union Building, where the eSports Center is based. And Wendy Kang is a student and budding eSports champion. Thank you very much both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
They have a Husky eSports mascot now, a little lapel pin that they hand out. And she told me, Chris, that it was contrary to what you might expect. There is physical conditioning that is necessary to have the endurance to sustain your attention on these games. And there are people who are born with the kind of quick muscle twitch and hand-eye coordination that makes you excel.
Fortnite is the devil.
That's just what I hear.
Yeah, just as a parent of a 17-year-old, in terms of taking away distractions, Fortnite is the devil.
Well, he could get a scholarship one day. Just keep that in mind.
Yeah, I know.
I know you're looking for the long snapper thing, but
certainly plays enough Call of Duty and Fortnite with his buddies online.
This might be a shortcut to the big leagues. You never know.
He's thought about it, believe me.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Climate change, we've discussed it to death. But one of the things that is bubbling just beneath the surface is what role nuclear power should play in trying to keep carbon out of the atmosphere. There seems to be a divide among environmentalists on this. Michael Schellenberger has recently written about this, along with climate scientist James Hansen in the Wall Street Journal. And so, first of all, Michael, would you consider yourself an environmentalist, a tree hugger?
Absolutely. Yeah, my entire life, ever since I was a child.
What does that mean exactly? Well, you're in favor of wind power, solar power,
No, I'm not. I used to be. In fact, I was one of the main advocates for the $150 billion that the country invested in renewables between 2009 and 2015. But in the process of it, we just kept encountering all sorts of problems, mostly environmental problems involving destructions of wilderness, the deaths of, incredibly important threatened species from desert tortoises to bald eagles. And the resistance to big wind and solar farms was coming from conservationists like me. So I started to change my mind over a period of years, in particular after some people pointed out that we ought to take a second look at nuclear. And nuclear had always been scary to me. I always thought that it was like the bomb. And the more I learned about it, the more shocked I was that most of what I believed about nuclear was just untrue, and that it's actually always been the best source of electricity from an environmental point of view.
But, of course, nuclear power, there are people who are philosophically opposed to it for various reasons, including Three Mile Island, Chernobyl.
Three Mile Island is an accident that actually proves the safety of nuclear. I mean, here you have a full meltdown of the reactor, and nobody was harmed. I mean, if you're standing right next to the plant, you got something like the amount of an X-ray. You get more exposure to radiation when you fly in jet planes than you do from Fukushima and Three Mile Island. You know, the contrast between what people believe and what the reality is huge. I mean, I don't know of any other issue where people's beliefs and the reality are so different from one another.
You're sort of an apostate among environmentalists, though, aren't you? I mean, they do not like you. There are websites saying that you're in somebody's pocket. So respond to that.
I'm not. I am financially independent. I always have been. We do not accept support from any energy interests. In fact, it's quite the opposite. We've documented that all of the big environmental groups, Sierra Club, NRDC, EDF, both take money in the tune of tens of millions of dollars a year and are invested in both natural gas and renewables. So, you know, it's actually quite scandalous, and most people don't want to talk about it because we tend to think that renewables are good and natural because we have what we call a appeal to nature fallacy. We think that solar and wind are more natural or better for the environment because they run on solar and wind. The sun and wind have two problems. The first is that they don't generate electricity when you need it, and then they generate too much when you don't need it. So that California has to pay Arizona right now to take all of our excess solar electricity. And Germany has to pay its neighbors to take all of its excess electricity. I just wrote a story about a new study from the University of Chicago, which is the biggest study to date. And it finds the exact same thing. Solar panels and wind turbines are making electricity much more expensive around the United States for three reasons. The first is the unreliable nature of sunlight and wind. The second is because they require so much land, so much more land. I mean, 450 times more land for a solar farm than for a nuclear plant to make the same amount of electricity. And then the third reason is that you have to build all this additional transmission lines. And transmission is extremely expensive. It's also really bad for the environment. When you look at it, you realize that the same reason renewables are so bad for the environment is the same reason they make electricity so expensive. Now, hydroelectricity has traditionally been very cheap. I mean, and nuclear plants, similarly, they're like similar to hydroelectric dams in the sense that once you build them, the cost of operations and maintenance are pretty low, a little bit higher for nuclear than for hydroelectric dams, but they can last for about as long, 60, 80, 100 years. So it's really a long-term investment, and I think that's how you have to look at it. It's something that we're doing in the same way we build bridges and highways and canals. We build hydroelectric dams and nuclear plants. Those are the two main ways we're going to have to reduce carbon emissions.
To actually have an impact, how many new nuclear plants would you have to build in the U.S.?
Well, right now we have about 99 or about 100 reactors providing 20% of our electricity. So if you wanted to get to 100% nuclear, you would need something like another 400 reactors. Now, you can build them on the same plant sites. The cheapest way to get new nuclear is just to build more reactors on the same site. So that's what we would end up doing. It would take decades, but that's the time scale of climate change that we're dealing with. And what we find is that, you know, every study shows that when you compare apples to apples, nuclear is the fastest way to decarbonize electricity supplies. And it's the only way to completely decarbonize them. I mean, the only two countries that have basically gotten to almost zero fossil fuels in their electricity mix are Sweden and France. And they did so primarily with nuclear, but also with hydro.
So it's your position that if anybody who is really serious about reducing the proportion of carbon in the atmosphere, there's really no choice but to go to, but to become as nuclear as possible.
That's definitely where I've come to. I mean, there's certainly people that think that you can capture the carbon and store it underground from fossil fuel plants. I mean, you can do that, but you're talking about a huge new infrastructure at a much higher cost than just building nuclear. People think you can do renewables, but it's just proven to be very expensive and ends up locking in natural gas. So at the end of the day, I think that nuclear, it's kind of a Cinderella story. You know, it's the sister who got, who the stepsister has always said was the dirty one. They made her do all the hard work. And she turned out to be the most beautiful one, the smallest environmental footprint, the least amount of waste, and the safest way to make electricity. It was sitting in front of us the whole time. And for a variety of kind of political and cultural reasons, we haven't been able to see it properly.
And so, I think it's fair to say that the highest profile environmental candidate running for president is our own governor, Jay Inslee, who has said that climate change is the number one issue. He has been, what shall I say, noncommittal when this nuclear energy argument is brought up as the best way to achieve lower carbon emissions. Have you talked to him at all?
I've known Jay now for 15 years. I like Jay. I think it's hard for a lot of baby boomers. You know, I mean, it's just, I think if you grew up during the 60s and even the 70s, I mean, it was even me, I grew up in the 80s, and there was just so much fear of nuclear. And I think it really had an impact on our unconscious, just setting aside the rational parts of our brain. We know that a lot of our behavior and beliefs are driven by the unconscious. And I think that if you grew up in the 60s or 70s, you had to duck and cover and practice nuclear war. I mean, right. It was terrifying. So I think a lot of people, honestly, I think a lot of us just suffered a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder from all of the fear of nuclear. And it's very hard to get over that. And then I think the second issue is, I think that if you're an environmentalist and you love nature, you just kind of think that solar and wind would be better because it's sunlight and wind. And it's hard to get your head around the fact that actually they end up having huge environmental impacts. And it's one of the things we know about how our minds work is that the more time we've spent advocating for something, the less likely we are to admit that we were wrong. You know, I mean, that's been the hardest thing for me. And I think for everybody, it's just to kind of admit, hey, I was wrong about this. I think Jay's a good guy. You know, I think it would be a great service to everybody if he would come out much more strongly for nuclear.
Michael Schellenberger is the founder and president of Environmental Progress at environmentalprogress.org. Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm the baby boomer, of course, and I grew up in northern Westchester in the evacuation area for the Indian Point nuclear plant, which is still operating. We got a tour of it when we were in school and has not had any problems that I've heard of. Anyway, if anybody has read Michael's stats and understands his charts and has and wants to refute it, then let us know, because we want to cover this. But he's the first guy who's actually said, yeah, you can get to zero carbon emissions. Just build nuclear and you're there.